Hello, fellow Gunters. This is Brian, and I want to welcome you to another fantastic episode of Late Night with Brian Wecht. Now, this week, as pretty much every week, there is a video version of this episode available on our Patreon, which is patreon.com/late night. You can go over there, sign up at any tier to get access to that. And also, if you sign up at the $5 a month or more tier, you get an extra mini episode every week. It's really fun stuff, and it is the way to support the show financially. We're not doing ads or anything like that. We go entirely through Patreon, so if you can go over there, sign up at any tier, we'd really appreciate the support. All right, enjoy this episode with an old friend of mine, the amazing Maki Naro. Here we go. We're doing it. We haven't had a guest in a little while, it feels like, but it's nice to be back. So, Maki, remind me, where are you in the general vicinity of the world?
Right now I'm in Syracuse. We moved up here in 2019.
Oh,
just
shit.
Before everything went down.
Yeah.
That's a whole other story, but, yeah.
I totally forgot that. And now I feel, extra bad because I was touring through Syracuse like 2 months ago.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, we played, what was it called? The Song and Dance downtown. And it might not be called the Song and Dance. Whatever it's called, don't go there. It was awful.
Oh, no.
It was a great show, but a sweaty basement with bad sound is how I would categorize it. But that's a bummer.
Brian, you're just describing your own home.
Yeah, well, it's where I feel most comfortable. Actually, I live in a sweaty basement with great sound. Personally, but yeah, it's Syracuse seemed actually like it was pretty cool. Like I really liked that little downtown. I went to the Canal Museum,
nice.
Which I thought was great. Yeah, I was pretty impressed, honestly.
Yeah, it's not bad. There's some. I mean, it's like weird that you know Interstate 81 runs like right through the middle of the city, and that's a whole other political disaster story. But it's nice. At the same time, you know, we moved up here, COVID hit, and so like I still feel like I'm new here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's just so hard to get out and explore, and like you know we still don't do indoor dining, mm-hmm. And other stuff unmasked, so it's just like, oh, where can we eat that's outdoors, and that cuts down the amount of places we can explore. And
right,
we do a lot of trails. There's a lot of great trails up here.
Yeah, it's a
that's
very
sure.
pretty part of the country for sure. Is there a food thing that Syracuse is known for?
Yeah, salt potatoes. Because
do tell.
So the primary industry up here for a long time, and maybe even still is. I don't know the exact. There's a salt museum, which I should probably have gone to read up on this stuff. But
and that's where I live.
There's a lot of salt production, which you know erroneously for the longest time I thought was in mines. So I was like, oh, you know, the kids, you know,
the
kids to the salt mines. They are not salt mines. It's you know, it's mineral. They would basically pump boiling water down into aquifers or whatever the term is, and it would come up all salinated, and then they would evaporate the salt out of it.
Oh, but that doesn't sound as cool as salt mines.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like, I almost just want to keep telling people they're salt mines. but anyway, so salt potatoes. So these workers at these, they're salt mines now. That's we're just going to go with that.
Yeah.
Would be
salties,
you know,
I think they call themselves. Yeah.
But they, you know, they one mealtime would come around and they would just, you know, dump their potatoes in all this salty water that they had around and boil them.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the Syracuse delicacy.
So that is a boiled potato, but boiled in
it's just
high
boiled
salt
in
water.
Very salty water. Yeah, and they're little potatoes too, so you get the most salt penetration, I guess.
Uh-huh. Boiled. Oh baby, let's go.
Are they good?
Yeah, I love them. You know, you put a lot of butter on them.
Mm-hmm.
Salty potatoes with butter, you can't go wrong.
Yeah, it's a kind of a time-tested concept, right?
What's your favorite form of salted potato? There are many forms.
Definitely French fries.
Okay.
I'm simple. French fries are kind of the, you know, again, you fry the potato and you put salt on it and
Mm-hmm.
And are we a dipper? Are we dipping things? What's the sauce hierarchy for you?
You know, I'm generally not a dipper. I had to think back, and I think like if a sauce is given to me, I'll dip, but I'm also perfectly fine
mm-hmm.
with a good fry.
I'm sorry that I told you that we weren't doing gotcha journalism when I've just immediately gone to the most
I know.
Exploitative thing possible.
The anti-dippers are going to cancel me.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you really don't want them on you. I would say if I had to pick like a mayo, Brian.
But on a fry.
An aioli, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a ketchup person, but I think that if a fry is good, the fry should stand alone. But sometimes... That's
100% true. Mayo is, I think, indisputably the best condiment for fries. Europeans have known this for centuries. We're just kind of grokking it now, I think, as Americans. But it's the best. And I feel like it's still kind of stigmatized, but unfairly.
There's a big mayo stigma in this country.
There's.
Yes.
And sometimes fairly. I will say, usually like, if you get...
Sorry, I was just saying mayo stigma are usually found on mayo Jesus. Which, yes, is one of my many nicknames. So I interrupted you to do a stupid bit, Maki. Please continue.
I was going to say, if you get a chance, get a hold of some Japanese mayo.
Oh,
that's
my, always my. Yeah, there you go. You know, tangier, zestier.
Yep, that is a go-to kind of
no weak mayo that is usually what is denigrated here in the States.
Yes, and a squeezier bottle too for the QP mayo. Yeah. It's a much better bottle. Yeah.
Squeezier, and I once made deviled eggs with QP and like some little furikake and wasabi. They're the best deviled eggs I'd ever made.
That'd be awesome.
I've taken to putting QP mayo if we'll do like chicken teriyaki bowls. Little bit of like QP mayo in with that is fucking great.
I'll just like drizzle a little bit on stuff, on anything.
Hell yeah. Yeah. I know a guy, and we're not going to mention any names here, who cannot be in the same like room with mayonnaise or he it makes him ill. And I think often about, he's a very dear friend. And also I think about how sad his life must be because he is deprived of what I consider to be the condiment royalty, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, Brian likes to play this game called Is It Mayo? Where
I do.
He will feed people who are blindfolded a big heaping spoonful of, and I'm not going to reveal what it ends up being.
It might be mayo. It might not. That's the thing.
If you were here with us in person, Maki, would you be willing to subject yourself to the Is It Mayo challenge?
It's one.
Yeah, why not?
Let me set it up.
Why not?
I don't think you really explained the subtleties of the game.
No, you're right. I'm sorry. You're expert. You're the mayo expert.
I blindfold people and I give them a spoonful of an unknown substance. And then they ingest the substance, or not. They can spit if they're cowards. And they have to answer one very, very simple yes or no question. And Leighton, what's that question?
Is it mayo?
Is it mayo? That's the game. People love to play this game.
Debatable.
Sometimes it's mayo.
It's always mayo.
It's often.
Ah, you spoiled it.
It's often mayo, is what I would say. Mm-hmm. Now, but often admits the possibility that 100% of the time could be often, right?
I mean, the last time that he did this in front of me, he prepared a bag of other condiments that the person playing wouldn't even have seen, but he did it for just like the foley of a peanut butter jar and a soy sauce bottle clacking
smart.
Together.
Yeah, I clinked a spoon around some glass bottles just to throw them off the scent. It was a real false flag type operation, and I think it worked.
I'm glad all the other options are, you know, are actually edible things, because, you know, like I expected this game to take, you know, slightly more off kilter turn, where it might not be mayo, but it might not be food either.
Like, a nice pile of glue.
This is Vaseline. This is salted Vaseline.
I'm a sadist, but I'm not cruel.
All right. I do know that you're an enthusiast of eating paste. And that would be like mayo, like in
me.
certainly not me.
Brian, you've been so on it with the talk show host like pen pointing thing that
I don't
felt
know. It's my new thing.
All right, here we go.
I love it. I was
aha. Oh, and you've got a real artist. Is that a little Statler mechanical pencil?
Actually one of those technical pencils from a million years ago that I found. And
is that a blue, like an HB blue tip?
I was looking for more leads and a little like tip sharpener. My wife and I have a kind of consolidated art box where we've thrown all our traditional media together, and I was rummaging through there and found all my stuff. I couldn't find all my blue line leads. So this is just, you know, peasants HB or something.
Now, okay, I'm pretty out of the loop. Well, first of all, everybody, this is Late Night with Brian Wecht. My name is Brian Wecht. Across from me here, we have Leighton Gray. Say hello, Leighton Gray.
Hello, that's me. That is this podcast's, as relevant to this discussion, art school dropout mystery guest. Would you care to introduce yourself? Wow, I haven't said that line in a while.
It's been a while.
Hey, everyone. I'm Maki Nero. I am an artist and illustrator, once styled feral cartoonist, science communicator, comic journalist. I've worn a lot of hats over the years.
Yes, but mostly around art, right?
Yes.
Yes, indeed. And for context, Maki and I met in New York about 15 or so years ago, in science type circles. It was through Story Collider, right?
It's through Story Collider. It was like the height of my like hustling age, where I think I had two friends speaking at one, and like after the show, I just like walked up to you, Ben, and Aaron, was like, "Hey, I'm an artist. Like, I'll draw stuff for you if you want." And sure enough, I did.
Yes, indeed.
It went from there.
Yeah. I don't really talk about Story Collider much on this show, but for those of you who don't know, Story Collider is a science themed storytelling show that I co-created, in New York in 2010. You know, is basically when we started it, and it's still going strong. I haven't done it for many, many years. But they're still doing shows and putting out podcasts and stuff like that. So, and now it's like a whole nonprofit type thing. But yeah, so that's how we know each other. And we've been, you know, following each other online ever since. And actually for years, Maki, I see your name pop up on, you know, wherever, Twitter or Blue Sky or whatever. And I've, you know, probably for 5 years at this point, or as long as we've been doing this show, I was like, man, I should get Maki on. I'd love to talk to him again. And finally, I saw you on Blue Sky one day and I was like, No more waiting. Now's the time. because you're just the best. Like, I love your art.
Thank you.
And it's so great to meet, so great to meet someone who has an equal passion, it seems like, for art and science, and so effortlessly and successfully fuses both of them. I'm just such a fan of what you do. And I thought people who like the show would be as well. So I wanted to make sure everybody found out about all your great stuff.
Damn, that's really nice. It's a lot of praise.
It's deserved.
I'll do my best to live up to that.
But what really, actually, the real reason I wanted you on the show is because, Leighton, I feel like often we don't get a lot of artists, like visual artists, on the show for you to talk to and talk about art stuff with.
You're saying that like I'm a zoo creature in an enclosure who needs enrichment by being around other creatures.
Well,
I actually bristle at that.
I agree with all of those things.
If you're gonna do that, you have to give us treats also.
I can get you some treats. Let me just place a DoorDash order. Okay. Treats coming. But no, I thought it would be fun also to hear two talented artists talk about similarities, differences, what have yous. But we were about to get into a very deep pencil discussion.
Right,
which is why I wanted to introduce the show and give some context. So tell me about pencils. Because here's what I know. I was recommended some Black Wings, and I've been using these 223s, and I have no idea. I think I heard like fucking Cory Doctorow talk about pencils once.
Oh my God, like, the okay. President of Oasis?
That's the one, the Cory Doctorow. Let's hope nothing happens to him, or Wil Wheaton will be in charge. So anyway, I want to hear you guys talk about pencils because I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about.
Brian, in so, Maki, this is other important context. When I was in art school, I was a sequential art major, so I wanted to do comics and stuff, and then very quickly learned that that was not a thing that my brain is built for. But Brian, if you, like, one of the basic things that you needed in every class was, like, a mechanical pencil or a regular pencil that has a certain shade of light blue, and that's, like, a really important part of your process. Could you guess what, why that's important to the comic making process?
Why
light
blue?
If you're working traditional,
you might want to be careful with that pen there, Layton. If you're going to have a writing implement, you can't drop it.
I accidentally took a screenshot.
Yeah. Why is light blue? I would guess so you can do, this is based on just pure guesswork, like outlines and then erase them later would be my guess.
That's close enough. Yeah. It's because the blue, after you do inks on top of something, it's just easier to drop out that tone of blue in Photoshop or what have you after you've scanned things in.
Yeah. And going further back than that, it's because it wouldn't reproduce when you photocopied or, you know, scanned it in traditionally. Yeah. Non-repro blue is, I think, the technical name because it wouldn't register, you know, all you'd be left was the inks.
Oh, and then that kind of moved into the next phase, which is it's easy to key out or whatever when you're doing Photoshop. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, like I know a lot of artists still like do their like sketch layers in like a lighter color blue or some other lighter color. It's also just, it's nice. You could, you know, it's easier to see. Like I'm a monster and I'll just, you know, do my sketching digitally and I'll just like I'll lower the opacity a little but yeah it can get pretty messy and having it be a separate color helps.
There's also like I always hated using them because like I could never find the right softness. Like there's something about the hardness of those blue pencils that just is not conducive to sketching for me.
They're like hard to write with.
We're always really hard lead.
And like, if I'm sketching, I want to be doing like a really light sort of thing. So yeah, okay. So this is a thing that I have not thought about. Aim's lettering guides. I have no idea where mine is, but.
Maki, your expression on that. So
I've never used one.
Really?
I worked at Pearl Paint in New York for a year and we sold them, but I've never used one.
Did you work at the one on Canal? The big one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Before it, you know, F's in chat for that, that institution. And
yeah. So what is this? This is a guide to lettering, presumably.
Well, so it's like a little bit of plastic that it probably would make more sense if you Googled it, but it's got like a hard edge and it almost is like a spirograph looking thing. Okay. But the idea is that you have one of your like T-squares or a ruler and it's how you create the lines that you write speech bubble dialogue or descriptions on so they're well spaced.
And so that was the letters, it's the lines.
Yeah, it's making the lines to put letters on. But I kind of can't believe that how much in the year sort of in like 2016 that I had to do, you know, that I was graded on my ability to use an Ames lettering guide. I'm glad I don't have to do that, but it is a pretty cool little thing to have in your toolkit.
Yeah. Are you, Maki, did you go to art school?
I did. I didn't study illustration at all. I actually, it's funny, in high school I was drawing, you know, like I was drawing web comics in high school. You know, I'm sure like a GeoCities. I actually posted about it on Blue Sky a while back.
Hell yeah.
I was drawing, you know, like I didn't have a scanner. Do you remember the Apple QuickTake?
No. What is that?
It was like one of the first or at least early digital cameras. It looked more like, you know, it was like this big, I feel like. And it looked more like a little like projector. Like as far as like the shape.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes. I didn't realize what it was called.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And it's just this big chunky digital camera. And my dad had one and I would draw these comics about EverQuest in pencil and like stand over them and like take pictures.
Yes.
And that's how I'd get them onto the computer and then like post on some janky website somewhere.
Hell yeah.
That's awesome.
Is EverQuest still a thing?
I think it is. Wow. I feel like I went to the website and they're still doing stuff.
That's been around forever.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so I went to college and I did literally everything else. Kind of focusing on, by the end, I was doing metal sculpture and a little bit of like video as a way to try to do flash animation. Boy, remember Macromedia Flash and how all that turned out?
Remember being able to own Flash and not pay for it monthly?
I mean, not that I owned it back then.
Right.
For legal reasons, you could cut that part out. But,
there's no statute of limitation on murder and stealing Flash. So if we keep that in, I mean, you're fucked, basically.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. No.
We're all going down.
Yeah, for something. For me, it's murder, but. Yeah. Did a couple back in the day.
So after you graduate, did you graduate?
Yeah.
But after college, when did you start getting into like comics and art and science communication as a career?
So right after I tried doing like Cape Comics, as you might call them, like Marvel, DC stuff. And that's when I was like, yeah, using blue lines. I had the big sheets of comic board that had, again, like all the like bleed and stuff marked on them. Yeah. And I was doing a bunch of unpaid jobs on Digital Webbings. That's the name of the site. It's basically a job board where I'm sure nobody got paid. Oh. And a lot of work was done and just sent off into the ether. Who knows? I mean, maybe people did all right on there. I did not.
And you're drawing these on paper or digital?
Yeah, paper.
Paper.
Okay. By then I had a scanner. So I like draw them on paper and scan them in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't get a tablet until, I don't remember when, maybe like 2008 or 2009. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what kind of tablet was it?
It was an Intuos 2 Wacom.
That's a good one to start with.
Yeah. It was like, you know, one of their, I think it was like $50.
Mm-hmm.
Figured I'd give it a try.
And was that with GIMP? Or Clip Studio Paint or Photoshop?
I think Photoshop. I don't think Clip Studio. When did I? Yeah, Clip Studio, formerly Manga Studio.
Oh, right.
When I first got it. I think I got it at like Manga Studio 5. But yeah, I did Photoshop for the longest time. And then, yeah, switched to Clip Studio. Mm-hmm. And oh, cool. I still end up using both because Adobe has such a stranglehold on everything.
Yeah. Now, is this the kind of thing, Leighton, hearing this, so Maki is closer to my age than yours, is this the kind of thing where that sounds like, oh, that was a long time ago type stuff, or not, do you?
No, I mean, my first tablet was a Wacom Bamboo. I had, what was it? Sketchbook Pro? Mm-hmm. Was my first, I think, because it came with the tablet or something like that, or Corel Paint. Those were,
you know, he was later cast on The Office, actually. A lot of people don't know this.
Good bit. Sorry, comedy experience.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It was a different era. And I, are you an iPad Procreate user?
No, you know, I keep kind of toying with the idea because I would love like a more mobile setup, but I don't know, like I think part of it is because I do everything on PC, I worry about just moving stuff back and forth. Like my wife loves it, she has an iPad and I've played with it a bit, but I just can't bring myself to make that jump just yet.
That makes sense. I will say, as somebody who's a big PC person and doesn't have any other Apple products, like you can, there are alternatives to AirDrop that work pretty seamlessly that you can use between your PC and your iPad, and like Procreate files transfer to Photoshop really well generally. But like the freedom of Procreate, I mean, just like completely changed my relationship to digital art after a decade plus of Photoshop and a Cintiq. So
what makes it so much better?
Procreate is a lot more intuitive with the asterisk that if you're somebody who's been using Photoshop for a decade plus, I think it feels kind of impossible to some people to make that switch because it's so, you have so much muscle memory from Photoshop and like the stupid ways that you have to go out of your way to like use it for illustration. Whereas Procreate is like very directly designed for illustrators. And I find it really intuitive, but I know plenty of people who just completely bounce off of it. But it's also just the portability of here's this light little thing with a pen that's always charged that I can just lay in bed or throw in my bag. Because my old, all my old digital art setups, it would be like I have to be at my desk hunched over my big tablet.
Yeah.
So, so it, that's...
And there's nothing quite... That was the first thing like that that was as portable, basically.
There was like the Cintiqs that operated as their own standalone computers, but they were never really good. And then the Microsoft Surface, I had like a Surface Pro 2 or something. The
So did I.
I loved it. It was, it's a great, those Surface tablets are awesome, but I hated the pen responsiveness on it because I think it served really well for like super cartoony stuff. And whenever I did really cartoony stuff, I was like, oh, this is awesome. And then if I tried to like do portraiture or sketching or whatever, it was just a little bit, the sensitivity wasn't right. Anyway.
I also want to ask Maki, so that's your art background. What about science? What's your history with science? It's like that Cronenberg movie, A History of Science.
That was a good one.
Hey, I'm full of really good ones.
No, I have no scientific background outside of like kind of a Robert Krulwich, you know, curiosity. You know, I've always kind of admired his role in that like Radiolab duo as the guy who doesn't know anything, but he's just really curious. About everything, and it's,
oh,
it's
like
a great...
my job.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, that like, but yeah, so that's where I am. So it's a lot of like, you know, I was just really into learning about stuff or curious about things, and
yeah, great,
you know, would do a lot of my own research and would, you know, fuck things up all the time.
So you do not have a math brain, is that fair to say? Or no?
Not at all.
Okay, great.
Solidarity.
Cool. Yeah, lady too. But this
that was meant
is,
to be a high five, but felt more like I was just slapping you. Sorry.
Get out of here.
What you should have done is booted him from the call the moment you did that, lady. That would have been a very, it's a good way to go.
Wait, I should do that to you all the time. Like,
yeah, just like bam.
Swat
and then,
like you're an annoying fly. Anyway, yeah. Sorry, continue, Maki.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that that's even more impressive, right? Is that this is because you're the stuff you do, you're careful about, but it just, I mean, it really just goes to show all you need. You don't need to have a math brain or a science brain to be an effective science communicator, right? Which you very much are. Like, you just need to be curious and careful. And that's pretty, you know, those are the two big things.
I always approached it as like if I could understand it and then like relay the information.
Yeah.
You know, right. That's all you needed. And it was always great, you know, more recently I work with, you know, writers a lot, particularly want to shout out Matthew Francis, physics writer. So many comics with him and he's amazing. And like, and there were so many topics. I always look at a comic we did about quantum teleportation and explaining that. And like, I had no idea what was going on. You know, it'd come up in the news like several times and I still had no idea. But working with him on that comic, like I was able to get it and then like come up with some funny pictures to go in this comic. And then I hope that helped other people kind of understand what was going on.
I follow him online. I don't know him personally. But, you know, I'm always interested in especially physicist communicators. I really like him. Actually, I don't think I've read much of his stuff, but online, I think he's a great presence. So, yeah, he's a fun one. He was talking. You know what? Actually, I don't want to get into this. He was talking about a string theorist that really fell off the rails. Yeah, there are a lot. But what's interesting about scientists that really fall off the rails is. There are a lot of physicists. I guess there's a lot of everybody, but Yeah, it is very weird to see these guys, you know, or people, I should say, that start out seemingly with a commitment to science and then just go, where the fuck, how'd you get over there, kind of thing. Always baffles me. It seems to be often more engineers than anything else, you know, the engineers who think Einstein was wrong, that type of person. But there's a difference between crank, like scientific crank, and you know abhorrent political views.
Yeah, Matthew and I did a whole comic on basically physicists who've gone that route, you know.
Oh, tell me more, please.
Diving right into race science and stuff like that. Shilling for big tobacco or climate change denial, and you know, using their platform as, you know, brilliant physicists to
right. Well, I learned something interesting semi-recently. So when I was in grad school for physics, the kind of standard thing was if you couldn't get a job, an academic job, which most people, it's very hard, so most people can't, regardless of ability, the kind of de facto thing you would do is go into finance, right? You would become a quant somewhere because you know math, and you'd end up, you know, making vastly more money than you ever would as an academic. So, you know, the recurring joke among postdocs, grad students was if you're not lucky enough to get an academic job, then you'll go make, you know, $500,000 a year doing something else. But what I learned was for many years that the go-to career path for a promising theoretical physicist who couldn't get an academic job was in you'd go to like an oil industry or something like that, because there was a big oil boom for a while and they were just hiring. And so there was this kind of pipeline from physics to
pipeline.
The oil industry. Oh, you know what, Layden, that wasn't even intentional. This is how good I am at doing these things. I didn't even realize I was doing that, but yeah, true. So I wonder if there are any examples of these people who got shuttled into the oil industry because they couldn't make it in physics.
Yeah, I was going to look up the comic and see if that was some of the direct connection. Why theoretical physics? For the oil industry?
I think that's a good question. I don't really know is a short answer. I would guess, you know, some... What would I guess? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's something about being good at math, right? There may be modeling or something like that. I don't really know the answer, though. No. Yeah.
I was chinning up to ask, so you said that you started with some CAPE stuff. When did the synthesis of bringing science into your artwork kind of start to happen? What?
I think like, when was that? That was, so like almost 6 years after I completely burned out from doing that and not getting paid for anything and just being like, this is BS. This industry sucks. And I just stopped making comics for like 6 years. And then, in like 2010 or 11, I was working a job that was like, you know, 80 hours a week, you know, ridiculous hours, and not making any art, getting really depressed. And I just like, I don't know why the idea popped in my head, but I think it was just like, okay, Maki, you like drawing comics and you like listening to science podcasts all day at this, you know, horrible job that you have. Why don't you just, you know, you could put yourself on a schedule and make comics once or twice a week, you know? And that's kind of where that started, because it was all stuff I was already absorbing through podcasts, and every now and then I'd be like, all right, I'm going to draw a comic about this particular topic or this thing that just came out or, you know, whatever was interesting me. And it got me back into drawing regularly and drawing comics, and it was great. It was, you know, I eventually moved on from that job into, you know, a slightly not related, but kind of more tangentially related. I started work for the World Science Festival in New York.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I was when I met you, Brian.
Probably. Yeah.
And so, you know, like, yeah, I was doing, you know, I was doing website, you know, just simple web production stuff for them. But it was great because like every now and then I could like talk to a scientist or, you know, talk to a science writer and meet other science writers. And that kind of got me, you know, on the right track from there.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, the World Science Festival famously I mean, the way most people I know thought about it was like Brian Greene's thing, right?
He and his wife both hated that. But yeah, yeah.
But he was one of the founders of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the World Science Festival, which pretty much only happened in New York, but we always had cool speakers and, you know, all sorts of great events. Is it still going on? I feel like I haven't heard about it for a while.
Think so. I mean, being out of New York for as long as I have, I haven't really kept track, but I assume it is.
Yeah, I don't know. That was a good time, right around like that 2000 type era. Was a really fun time for, like, I feel it was the first podcast boom, right? or right around then. And there were so many, like, I remember, you know, getting into Radiolab and everything like that at the time. I feel like that was a really, it was this collective excitement about all these new, like, forms of science communication and podcasts and everything like that.
Yeah.
Right around them. What were, for you, what were the podcasts like you would, were in your rotation right around then?
There was a lot of NPR.
Yeah, same.
Around the same time I was getting into, you know, capital S skepticism.
Yes.
For better or worse. So a bunch of those.
Were you a skeptics guy?
Yeah, that's what got me into it.
Yeah. Have you worked with them? I can't remember. Have you worked with those guys at all?
No. You know, I worked with, and I'm still friends with Rebecca. Uh-huh. We still talk every now and then. And like, I was living in New Jersey, and I think she's from, I forget where, New Jersey. So we'd hang out like whenever she was in the area. So that was cool. But other than that, I don't think I ever did anything directly. You know, we'd all talk at the conferences and stuff.
Yeah. I do a lot of stuff to this day with the Skeptics Guide guys.
Oh, nice.
Like, they're actually, I just talked with Jay 2 hours ago. They've become like very close friends of mine.
Cool.
And we've organized a bunch of conferences and things together. But I also, right around then, I was like a fan of their podcast, and, you know, just kind of got into it. I remember listening to it when I was a postdoc and being like, oh my god, what, there are other people like. And it's interesting because the skepticism thing, there was this, you know, kind of older school form of skepticism, like this very Shermery why people believe weird things type thing that I now find extremely off-putting and kind of gross, honestly. And it, with the Skeptics Guide people, I was like, oh, this is a much better vibe than, you know, this other stuff that was starting to feel a little like, I don't know about this.
Yeah, like as years went on, and, you know, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and all of them, and it's just It was a slow, gradual nope out, but
For me, it was a punctuated equilibrium of nope outs, where, you know, Dawkins would post something, you'd be like, "Fuck you, nope, I'm done." Like, you could maybe see, you go, okay, maybe, I don't know, and then it's like, "Oh, nope, done with that one," and then it feels like this happens just regularly enough where you're like, "What are you talking about? Falling off the rails? Like, what are you fucking doing, dude?" You know, and a lot of it was, you know, misogynist, or in Dawkins' case, Islamophobic. You know, just really uncool, awful stuff. I feel like, at least to me, that world kind of split into, this is by far too simplistic, but into like assholes and not assholes, and I've continued to be in touch with the not assholes, but yeah,
I think that's something that's very special about science communicators like you guys, who are able to make things really accessible for people, because I think a certain era or type of science dude can be so off-putting to people who maybe are not familiar with the world, at least, you know, not the least of which because of its just like strident contrarianism or self-righteousness. Yeah. So I think that being able to present things to people in basic terms that they will understand and that's engaging and easy to read or listen to is a big help and probably a breath of fresh air for a lot of people.
Yeah. The self-righteousness thing, I think, is exactly the right word. Because it's like that this feel of like, I'm smarter than you. And that's why I get to explain this to you. Actually, did you know? It's like, fuck you. You're not smarter than other people. You just know a little more about this thing. You know, it starts to feel very self-congratulatory in a way that is very, very off-putting, I think.
Yeah. And you mentioned the misogyny, and that's where I, you know, like literally any time, you know, like, hey, there's, you know, science and especially skepticism and big A atheism has a bit of a misogyny, the pushback against that every time.
Oh my God.
It's like, oh no, you know, we're just being rational. You know, it's very, you know, there's, speaking of pipelines, like, I feel like there's definitely a, you know, big A atheist to alt-right pipeline where, that like whole facts, you know, like facts, not feelings is like the stuff they were saying back then. Right. Like,
I've told this story on the show before, but I remember I was a postdoc at Michigan briefly, and while I was there, I got asked to speak at a local skeptics group. Yeah, great. And so I go, and there were clearly two categories of people there, old guys and like younger people. And I gave some talk about, I forget exactly what, might even have been a talk I gave at Nexus, just some theoretical physics thing. And one of the old guys in the room, who I would guess was maybe in his mid-60s or so, you know, at the end, to say any questions, and this guy goes, I have a question for you. When I was a kid, there were two extra planets, but now they're gone. Why? And I was like, and he wasn't talking about like Pluto dwarf planet thing.
No.
He was saying there were two other planets that existed that now are being covered up. And I was really baffled, and yeah, I still don't know what the fuck he's talking about. And then the skeptics group explained to me that these guys were holdovers from the atheist era, which were more just about being contrarian. You know, atheist doesn't mean rational, right? It's just you're defining yourself in opposition to something. And so it was very interesting to see this split between old school atheists who were very conspiracy minded or could be, and kind of younger skeptics who were more just like pro science in general and not, you know, not and mostly atheists, but not defining themselves as atheists, defining themselves more as skeptics.
Yeah, what were the planet names?
What are the two planets that they're covering up? What don't they want us to know?
Yeah, hang on.
I
hear this guy out.
I would like, you know, we all want more planets. Vulcan, maybe one was Vulcan, but that wasn't when he was a kid. The Vulcan planet thing was a 19th century thing, wasn't it?
I didn't know about that outside of the Star Trek context.
Yeah, I believe the deal with Vulcan was... at some point, and I'm gonna guess it was like 1890, but I might have my dates wrong. Like late 19th century, they thought briefly there might be another planet, like close-ish to ours, not way out, but like close to ours. This is a great example too. So forgive the incorrect dates. And there was a brief period where they were like, "Oh, we think there's another planet." All the astrologers immediately revised all their things to take into account this planet, and then it turns out the planet just plain doesn't exist, and they were like, oh, oops. So yeah, for a minute I think people thought there was another planet. I might be wrong. I feel like it was like, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I feel like it was like hard to see, or it was kind of on the opposite side of something and it was hard to detect it, but there was some movement briefly that where scientists thought there was another planet that didn't end up being there.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. I'm suddenly remembering. Yeah, the hard to see thing wasn't. Yeah, what did they call that? It was like, yeah, like a planet X that was like,
exactly.
It was like on the opposite side of the Earth, so we just never saw it because the sun was
like,
in the way.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. It's exactly opposite the Earth on the other. It's like the what's that Another Earth movie? Right, there's an exact copy of the Earth.
Oh wow! Right? I forgot about that one.
Yeah, that kind of thing, maybe. So maybe that's what it was. It was like exactly opposite us on the other side of the sun, so we never saw it. But Anyway, yeah, I think a lot of these like atheist type figures tend to kind of go off the rails. You realize, oh, you're not pro-science, you just hate stuff.
I feel like another pipeline is like young men getting really into stoicism and like, I'm going to read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations and then it's slowly become a misogynist. Like, it just feels like another, like, this is all about logic. That just kind of turns into being an insufferable asshole.
Yeah. It's that whole, like, you know, you see it. Yeah. You see a bust of, yeah, Marcus Aurelius profile picture and you're like, oh, going to stay away from that one.
Indeed. Layton, please. Yes.
No, I was just spacing out looking at Maki's cool art in my other tab.
Please. Well, I sent you a Fallout related thing.
You did?
Maki did.
Oh, it was fun.
Because Layton, Maki, is a Fallout stan.
Who isn't?
I was hoping you would have put that like more offensively, Brian. I could have taken it.
You know what? No, I actually don't think I could have.
All right. Yeah.
Okay. Not like a Fallout, like trash goblin kind of level of fandom.
See, she takes that as a compliment. That's the issue.
It is a compliment. Yeah.
Yeah, I think calling me a Fallout stan is actually the most offensive thing that you could have said. Trivializing of my deep and abiding passion for it. Hey, I like seeing that thing that I like being used to explain interesting science stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm curious where your biggest like visual art influences are coming from when it comes to making comics. Like if you had to pick like three artists who have had the biggest influence on you stylistically.
That's a tough one. I feel like, I mean, Bill Watterson's up there filtered through many years now, but you know, that was kind of my entry into comics was Calvin and Hobbes. Was
very big
was
for me as a kid too. Yeah.
Absolutely floored by that comic.
Probably Marcus Aurelius too, right?
One of the ancient comics.
Yeah.
It's less so now. Like it's the more I think about it, like I'm trying to like think of influences and it's all heavily filtered where like it barely even shows now. But yeah, like you know, Calvin Hobbes, Hellboy, huge Hellboy fan. Mm-hmm. So all of Mike Mignola's work. And then the third, I don't know, heavily anime influenced in general. Mm-hmm. Anime and manga, definitely. Can't point to any specific artist that I can think of. Like, mm-hmm. you know, there's always just little bits where like, yeah, like reading something, I'll be like, oh, that's a really great way to do that. Or like, you know, like, oh, this looks so cool. And it just all kind of melds together.
Do you guys feel like, related to that, and I've always been curious about this, do you feel like your style is like, is what it is now, or is actively developing at this point in your lives, for both of you?
My answer is informed by the fact that I feel very stagnant in mine, in that my career has kind of shifted where it's not the primary focus, like... Right when I dropped out of art school, I literally went into a job as an art director after having had a job as an art director, and I was drawing constantly. And now it's not, you know, it's just kind of a useful skill that I have, and I feel like I don't put enough intentional practice into it to like do anything other than the same shit I've been doing for the past 15 years, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I hope it's still developing. I'm sure it is. It's just harder to see from my point of view where I'm doing it very sporadically.
Mm-hmm.
That's my answer. I'm sorry I jumped in first.
No. I've kind of got the same feeling because, I don't know, sometimes I feel like my style is, I can't keep the same style between like two panels. Like I'm always just jumping around and trying something different. And it's kind of what I loved about doing comics was each one gave me a chance, doing short form comics was that each one gave me a chance to just goof around and try something different. But I definitely feel like, yeah, like I've been pretty stagnant up until extremely recently where, I mean, I think I basically burnt out and like, I wasn't, you know, I was just drawing comics to be, you know, because I needed to, because I'm a full-time artist and I need the paycheck. And other than that, like, after I was done drawing comics, I wouldn't think about drawing at all. And it was a really rough spot, and I knew it was rough and it felt bad, and I just couldn't get myself out of it until like very, very recently. I've started, you know, being able to reconnect with it a little bit and have fun drawing. And so now I think like, yeah, like my style changes all the time. So I'll just be like, oh, that looks fun. Oh, that looks fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've noticed you do a lot of portraiture. Has that been part of getting back into it, or is that just like a thing you like doing?
Yeah, your portraits are awesome. I love your portraits. I was looking for the whole section.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Because like,
yeah, really cool. They're awesome.
It's so nerve wracking.
Really?
Like, portraiture is like, it's the thing that you know, people generally like, but like I get asked to do it, and I'm like, yeah, okay, like I can do that. It's so nerve wracking.
Is it like a likeness fear of like not getting the likeness?
Yeah, likeness thing, and just it's great. Yeah. I don't know which portraits you were looking at, but yeah, I've been doing the staff portraits for Knowable magazine, which is annual reviews like online.
I was just looking at the section on your website with some
Me
some
too, and the dogs.
Yeah,
the dogs are part of that recent thing where, you know, I don't have a job and just starting to do commissions again, and it seemed like I was, you know, painting my dogs for fun and as practice. Trying to brush up on a lot of, again, because I was feeling stagnant, and I feel like, oh, I haven't, you know, improved as an artist in like 6 years because I wasn't drawing for fun anymore. So part of that was like painting again and trying to improve.
I was gonna say that
portraiture
is one of those things that's very like not easy mode, but in terms of like sitting down and doing an art thing that feels really good, of just toiling on something like that for a while, is very satisfying and, dare I say, healing. But I really love how much you can feel the cartooning influence in your portraiture, because I think a lot of people kind of translate into doing it and then kind of fall into like a homogenous, very straight ahead style. But like, you just have so many of the little beautiful line art flares in there that make them really engaging.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
Is part of the stress of portraiture, I mean, for me, look, I have people drawing pictures of me and putting them online fairly regularly. And sometimes, of course, my response is, wait, what do you think I look like? You think, really? You know, is that part of the stress of like, you're going to show it to the person and they'll be like, what?
Less so that like I'll like draw it and I'll be like, who the hell is that? Like, what what is going on? Like, why can't I figure out the shape of their nose? Like, little thing. I mean, because that's the trouble for me, is that like it's such a subtle, you know, face features are so subtle, and you know, like just changing, you know, my wife has an illustration background, and you know, she did, you know, really gorgeous, like caricatures, you know, beautiful caricatures. And like, I feel like I could never get there, because as soon as like I make the nose a little exaggerated or different, all of a sudden it doesn't look like the person anymore. And I've failed.
Yeah. Doing a thing that involves portraits, if you're doing like, it's not just a commission, it's like client work. There was one job that I was doing where the person kept requesting changes to their bit of the portrait, but I kept getting notes to like change certain things about the face, but as I changed those things, it was losing the likeness. It's like, no, you look like that though. That's
oh no,
this is like, well, not a bad likeness.
This is the other thing, is when I look at pictures of me other people draw, I wonder how much I am deluding myself about what I actually look like. It's, you know, that's the big question, is like, I kind of think I look a certain way, as we all do. And it really makes you question kind of your sanity, because I'm, you know, I'm like, are my basic features what I think they actually are? And I really do not trust myself that statement is true.
I think that's kind of, I mean, I feel like everything's kind of like that, right? Like, every, you know, the voice, like how you sound, you know, I'm gonna listen to this later and be like, oh my god, why do I sound like that? you know, it's the whole thing over like nobody likes how they sound because you normally hear yourself as your voice through your skull or whatever the however the acoustics work. And I think same with your face, like, you know, we all have a kind of like our own picture of how we look inside. And honestly, like, I have my own image of what other people look like. And then like right now, no offense, Brian, but and this is nothing bad, but like I came on and I was like, all right, that's what Brian actually looks like. I don't know why, but for some reason, my mental picture was just slightly different.
Well, we haven't seen each other in person in a long time. Absolutely same. Right. I mean, honestly, most of what I see of you online is your little avatar, which is an illustration. Right. So yeah. And that's different than the actual you. So, I mean, same thing. I was like, oh, yeah, that's Mark. There he is.
It is funny how you start conflating people with their profile pictures.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I have not been a real frequent user on social media other than Reddit, lurking like a gremlin. In years, and so I'll pop back on and nobody has the same profile pictures anymore, and I don't know who anybody is, and I'm scared.
It throws me off so much.
But also, Layton, is this true, all your avatars are an illustration on social, is that right?
Yeah,
the ones I'm thinking of are,
and they're all very, very old.
It's like that purple thing with the glowing eyes, is that right? I can't quite remember.
What are you talking about, old man?
I don't know what I'm talking about.
That's just what I look like.
I also do have poor vision, so that's
no.
Part of
I still,
it too.
I still have like chin length hair in my little Instagram profile picture.
I don't even remember which one that is. Yeah,
Instagram, that website that I use all the time.
I was going to ask. Okay, I'm always interested in this. Hit me with your, if you feel like this is not an uncool question, your art pet peeves. What's shit you hate that people do?
Oh,
you don't
no,
need to call
people?
Out. You don't need to call out specific names, but just trends or whatever. You know you understand what I'm asking, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you can plead the fifth. You're allowed.
Yes.
But I'm also very interested in what the answer is.
Yeah.
You know I have them. I'm really bad at being put on the spot because now my brain is, it's like, you know, you say Maki, tell a joke, and all of a sudden I'm like, I've never heard a joke in my life.
Of course, yes. Yeah.
And I'm having the same thing now where I'm trying to think if there's anything I saw recently.
Layton, does anything occur to you?
The first thing that comes to my mind, and also I stopped using social media for many reasons, one of which was getting mad at other people for art stuff. My biggest one that I'm okay saying is cutesy gimmick, look at our relationship comics. There are so many of them.
Give me an example. I don't
where
know
it's
exactly
like,
what you're
talking about. Here's a cutesy version of me and my boyfriend. And there's no joke here, but I'm going to post this like there's a joke here. And the joke is just, look at us, we're so cute. There are so many of those. They make me...
Yeah. I quit Facebook many, many years ago, but I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, it's always like, look at us. We're, you know, and of course, they're always very attractively illustrated.
Yes, always.
Here's us doing our relationship gimmick things. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. They all suck.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a scourge, I say, about a thing that, you know, really has no net negative on anybody other than it irritates me.
That's what I'm looking for. This is what I'm looking for. This is the question I'm asking.
Those words came out of my mouth, and I was like, oh, like, because I think like I've definitely like if you ask me like again like maybe like 10, 15 years ago during capital S skeptic, capital A atheist, I you know like I look back at that, I'm like, oh man, I was probably insufferable back then. for the same reasons that a lot of people were, and that it was so like, it's so combative, you know, everybody was just like looking to get into online arguments and like, you know, confronting everything. And right now I'm just like, yo, that's your style and that's good, you know.
Totally. Yeah.
you have worth as an artist and you do your thing and don't listen to anybody else.
And this
that's
is
where
the
I am
thing
now.
I think about that. We talk about this on the show quite frequently, but you know, part of, I think, maturing is going from this is bad to this is not for me. Right.
Yes.
And one thing I try actively to inculcate in my child, who's now 10, is like, don't say that's bad. Say, I don't like that. opinion is fine, kind of value or moral judgment less so. Some things are genuinely bad, but let's maybe just say, hey, I'm not so into that. And I think that is a real sign of maturity and also not something internet discourse rewards, right? Internet discourse wants you to be like, this is bad. And if you like it, you're a monster. And you're like,
yeah, I don't like this. So I must manufacture a moral high horse upon which to sit about why nobody else is allowed to like it either. Because right. I don't.
Yeah. Exactly. Now you've drawn the line and
maybe that's
everybody can get there.
Yeah.
That's another thing that's an art pet peeve that isn't really an art pet peeve, but just if you spend any amount of time in artist spaces online, just how mired in ridiculous terminally online drama they all inevitably end up being. It's like, I like it when you draw pretty pictures. Can I just see the pretty pictures?
Yeah. The different drawing, then it's like cyclical too, where like, you know, you could count on every few months, the tracing is bad discourse starts up to the point where like the most recent one I saw people were calling inking tracing again, which was wasn't there a Kevin Smith movie where that was the whole thing?
Oh really? I don't remember that one.
It was Chasing Amy because it was about comic book artists, and one of the guys got shit on because he was the inker, and they're like, whatever man, you're just a tracer, you're just tracing the other guy's art. And he had to defend himself, but we were like right back there in like 2002 or whenever that movie came out.
Yeah, it's always some, and like I think being further away from it and having pretty much no connection to it now, so much of it is like someone reacting to something a literal child did, or vice versa, like an adult did something and then a bunch of children are upset by this, and then it's like 40-year-olds in the industry getting into endless fist fights teenagers.
Right.
But then
right.
It's like, well, you know, I did like your art, but why are you having fights every single day with children? Yeah. You're like, you're an industry professional? How?
Yeah, and you just told some 12-year-old that you think their art sucks? Like, come on.
100%. Not even that they're a bad person.
Right, yeah. One thing I always find fascinating is like Comic-Con drama where people get upset about table placement or things like that. Like, it's always fascinating to hear what someone is very, very upset about and needs the organizers of the con to respond to immediately. And you're like, it's 9 p.m. on a Saturday. Nobody is going to see this, right? Like, give them a beat and then they'll respond to it.
No, I was just going to say, I was trying to think if I ever had convention beef, but I think like one of the things I love about, you know, comics, web comics, you know, especially indie comics, I think that's the big thing, is that how supportive everybody is. So
yes,
but I know exactly what you're talking about, like Artist Alley beefs.
And I completely understand why people get upset about certain things. I totally get it. But yeah, from the outside, you're like, what do you
It's also this like really warped view of conflict resolution where the only like we can't interpersonally solve issues, our only recourse is like
take it public.
Piling. Yeah.
And sometimes you have to do that, of course, but it is just so weird to my first instinct with any conflict resolution is just talk to the person like a person and say, hey, this bugs me. It's like, can we work it out? And not immediately start tweeting about it to everybody who can hear you.
When chronically your very first solution is complaining loudly on Twitter, it's rough.
Sorry, which website are you
I said what I said.
I just don't think that...
You Gen Xer.
Yeah, well, oh, there. Oh, X. Yes, yes, that's right. Yeah, I'm a proud Gen Xer. That's true.
Big fan of Ernest Cline and his work. Yeah.
Big fan. Best writer of our generation. Yeah, he's like our Jack Kerouac.
we read Ready Player One for a bad book club that we did, and we recorded that episode over the weekend. And Brian, is it marinating harder in your head? Because it is for me, and the longer I think about it, the more angry I get.
Certainly, you know, the the thing about that book, this will now be the third episode in a row in which we talk about this book. The thing about that book is, at least for me, reading it, I'm like, oh, this is going pretty fast. I'm having a pretty good time reading this. It's not good, but I'm having a good time reading it. And of course, as you get further from it, the fun parts start to fade away and the bad parts sort of stick around. So that book is definitely, even though my estimation of it started out low, it is definitely cratering as I get farther away from having read it.
My biggest thing right now is just thinking about how the protagonist doesn't really have any skills or solves anything. The solution is either always, I've actually had this memorized since I was 13, or actually several months ago, secretly I did this thing that gave me an ability to not be affected by this that I already did, and I'm only just telling you now. So any conflict that there might be that I established in a previous sentence, in this next sentence, I'm telling you why it's no longer conflict and why I am so cool.
That's why that sequence in IOI is the best one in the book, because he actually has to do things real time that requires some innovation.
But even though most of that is predicated on, like, several months ago, I bought the secret access codes, and I actually meant to do that, and the money is going to wire to my account in a few days, like...
It's predicated on that, yeah, but actually, real time, he's actually doing something for the first time in the book.
In the real world.
I did not get that far in the book. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Where do you think you tapped out?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. I got it as, I was taking a flight somewhere. It might have been, like, flying to the West Coast or something. I got it as an audiobook to keep my mind occupied.
Narrated by Will Wheaton?
And wow, I did not last long.
Yeah, smart.
I did not last long.
Smart.
Well, speaking of a piece of media that's terrible, Brian, do you think it's time to move into the segment about ones that are good?
I think it is. All right, our first segment on the show is our pop culture recommendation segment. This is the point in the show, Maki, in which you get to describe something you've been enjoying recently. It could be a book, a movie, a video game, maybe a scientific paper, it could be a comic, could be anything you're enjoying. We say pop culture, could be high culture indeed, if that's what you're feeling. Occasionally we will have things like that. Usually it's pop stuff, and that is why the name of this segment is What's Poppin', and the theme song, which we insert during the extensive post-production process that every episode lovingly undergoes here. That theme song goes here.
What's poppin'?
What's poppin'? Fantastic. So, now it has... Nope. Nope, 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 nope. Pause. Not happening. You trying to play it again? Nope. Not happening. Dueling controller wars is what we have here. We've really dug our own grave with both having control of the post production or the
double edged sword.
What? It's popping. Can you see what's happening here, or can you just hear it, Maki?
I just hear. Is there like a video component too?
There's a back end where we can see the sound files and the volume, and we both have control over them, which is a bad idea.
It just kind of goes in and out like a wave. I catch little snippets.
Yep. I'm trying to play the theme from Saw, but someone won't let me. Perfect.
I just deleted it.
What the fuck?
It's easy to put back.
I was using that.
You can put it back once you've learned to behave. Anyway. So this is what I like to ask. Maybe not all, but most of our guests. So you didn't just hear the What's Poppin' theme song, but if you had heard it, what would your opinion have been, Maki?
I heard it on, I think I heard it on another episode.
Oh, great. And?
It's music.
Thank you. Okay, that's what I'm looking for. Great.
There we go. All right,
that's
there we go.
Another.
It's music with a little voice.
Another flawless review.
It's It's a good neutral. I have a good neutral opinion of it.
Great.
Not good. 100% serious, not good or bad. It's a jingle.
You know what? I'll take it. I will take it. One of the very few things that I consider myself a successful musician, because all of my music is identifiable as music. So I consider that a personal victory. Great. Layton, what's popping?
What's popping for me, as I've been on a bit of a reading books about prison kick, I have been reading A Bit of a Stretch by Chris Atkins, who's a documentarian who ended up, there is a fruit fly on my microphone. Please forgive me for what's about to happen. Sorry. Nope, it lived.
I really like that little sequence there. No, it lived. Yeah, great.
No, I felt it fall and fly away onto my body. So yeah, Chris Atkins, a documentarian who went to prison for tax fraud and wrote a memoir about his experiences being
in prison.
The Atkins
Diet.
Yeah, it's the name of the book. Mm-hmm. By Chris Atkins. Anyway, mm-hmm. It's really interesting because I read that Rikers Island book, which this is a similar, like, prison is bad, but it's interesting seeing the divisions of this is coming from a guy who has kind of like grouped up with the other white collar crime guys. Really interesting. I also read The Devil You Know, Adventures in Forensic Psychiatry. Not adventures, Ooh. Encounters in Forensic Psychiatry.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, it was by a psychiatrist who worked at Broadmoor, and a lot of really interesting little case studies. So that's been a fun little hole for me. That's what's popping for me. Maki, what's popping?
I had a few, but the most recent, like extremely recent, like a couple days ago, was I was clued in that, are either of you Godzilla fans?
I've seen a few things. I saw the latest one, and then a few random things in the past.
I like Godzilla as a concept. I could not point at Godzilla media that I'm like, yay.
I'm a big fan of his work.
Yeah. The artist formerly known as Godzilla. Huge fan.
Yeah, but I was clued in that Toho has a YouTube channel, and amongst their their collection is two ongoing seasons of a little cartoon called Chibi Godzilla, and the episodes are like 3 minutes long, shorter I think, and it's just the most like unhinged, like I don't know, it's just something about the delivery and the humor and. The way I've been describing it is it's like if you take Muppet Babies, right? Because they're all like children's version of the Godzilla monsters,
yeah,
goofing off on Monster Island. But also, if you took, have you seen any of the Mickey Mouse cartoons on YouTube?
The new ones,
yeah,
yes.
So like now I'm at yeah. So imagine Muppet Babies, but kind of with that tone, in that like okay, here's this like. Kind of ostensibly children's media, but it's clearly not. Like some of the jokes they make are, you know, for a higher, slightly higher level of understanding, although I'm sure kids would enjoy it too.
This character art is so cute. I want this little Godzilla design on everything I own. Hello Kitty Who? Don't need her. I've got Chibi Godzilla now.
The craziest thing, speaking of the Mickey Mouse thing, the craziest thing in the world to me is that the current voice of Mickey Mouse is Chris Diamantopoulos, aka Russ Hanneman from Silicon Valley, which is like a fact I cannot get over. Like blows my mind every time.
Anytime I see him in something, I'm like, that's the Mickey Mouse guy.
I know. And he plays his character in Silicon Valley is incredible. He's so good in it. This ultimate like tech bro asshole, like hot guy with a stupid cool car. It's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think where I first saw him, but I did not have him down as a voice guy, you know?
Like, right. Exactly. Yes. He was one of the Three Stooges in the movie too. I think Mo, but I could be wrong.
Well, I was just going to say, but yeah, it's super cute. And like, they're, you know, especially if you're a fan of Godzilla, like, they're not afraid to, you know, do some deep cuts and into Godzilla lore, if you will, and like pull out some like really weird stuff from, you know, especially because there's been so many different variations. Like, I'm waiting for the day that they bring out the, what was it, 1998 Godzilla they made here in the States?
Oh, the Matthew Broderick one?
Yeah. Like, yes. I'm waiting for like that one to show up at some point. You know, I don't know how the licensing works for that, but like, that's like kind of the where I could see them going with it, as far as like, hey, remember this one?
Do you remember the ad campaign for that one with its tagline?
I don't.
Tagline for 98 Godzilla: size does matter.
Oh, please tell me we've got like a poster of Matthew Broderick with that under it.
Poster, right?
Wow, gee, I wonder if this particular iteration was taking any tips from Jurassic Park at all.
Yeah,
as
right.
I'm Google image searching this, like, oh,
Yeah, it feels very, very 90s.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Do you think, Maki, would it be, is it like kid appropriate? Can I show it to Audrey?
I mean, there's no, it's, you know, it's like a lot of, you know, well, one, I think the biggest barrier is, it, you know, it's all Japanese and it all happens very fast. So I guess it depends on, you know, how fast you can read. And there might be some stuff lost in translation, because it is all, they do have it all subtitled in English. Yeah. But everything, because they're, you know, 2 minute, 44 second episodes, everything happens very fast.
Got it.
So well, that, you know, even I had trouble like sometimes being like, oh wait, those subtitles went a little too fast. But
it's this very is funny. So
and
cute.
Also, like the first season also has all these like great little PSAs after the credits, like for like climate action and gender equality and like, you know, workplace safety and things like that.
Well,
it's
that's
just
fun.
It's just very wholesome and fun and extremely goofy.
I love it.
Yeah, Brian, I'm watching this in the other monitor and I think Audrey would like it.
Can you pay attention to the show we're recording?
His poppin' was so good that I had to see it.
It's okay.
Brian, you'll understand when you look. I will watch it too cute to look away from.
Yeah.
Working implies that being paid. Mm.
No, that's true. I couldn't agree more. Speaking of that, what's popping for me this week? This is actually, I don't think I've ever done this before. What's popping for me this week, this is going around a bit on the socials. It is the live stream of a watering hole in the Namib Desert in Namibia. Have you seen this, Mark?
Yes. Yes.
And it's like, the animals are out. You want zebras, you want, you know, sort of gazelle variants or whatever the fuck those things are. They're all out and they're drinking at the hole and it's awesome. And the best part is there's sound, right? So it's not just an image, it has sound as well. The channel is Namibia Cam and they might have more than one, actually, I don't know. But this one is really great. It's like a little watering hole that is like, shit's going down there right now. And it's awesome. I've been watching it with Audrey. You know, because of the time difference between there and California, often it's night, but they have like, you know, night vision cams. There's often something cool happening.
I'm looking at that night vision cam at this very second. And I was, I'm
anybody out?
No, other than bugs jump scaring me, because it's a very eerie image.
Yes.
It's very stark. I mean, that could be like an abstract painting with that particular like branch and this little watering hole.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
The chat's popping off.
Oh, I was saying, like, yeah, that's what, you know, normally when I go to a YouTube page and the chat comes up, I'm like, oh God, get rid of that, get rid of that. I don't want to see it, but it's all very good. It's good chat.
Yeah.
That's good, I've seen anyway.
Good animals.
Chat,
classic,
is this real?
Animal cam. Also, coming off of, you know, where the some good bear cams happening in Alaska in the recent past, because it's that time of year, watching bears lay around in the river and chomp on fish, you know. Now we're going to this Namibia cam. It's a good time to be alive.
It's a great time to be a gamer.
Yeah, indeed it is. Speaking of that, do you want to introduce our next segment?
Yes. Now it's time for our final segment, which is 3 parts gratitude exercise, 1 part petty grousing. The name of the segment is Peaches and Lemons, and the theme song goes right here.
Peaches and Lemons.
Great. That was the theme song. Now, we will each start with a lemon, which is a thing that is a minor bummer, annoyance, what have you. I will start.
Great. Go. No, go, 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 go.
As is tradition. My lemon today is, I hate the thing where if you don't get enough sleep, that has its own bevy of issues. My number one with that, why do I feel conscious of every square millimeter of my eyeballs?
Oh, my God. Uh-huh. Yep.
Why do you feel your entire eyeball? Because that's the thing that kills me. I mean, like, I don't have energy. I'm a little spaced out today, whatever. That's fine. Why do I feel my eyes so much?
Mm-hmm.
That is my lemon. I'd like to not feel the back of my eyeball.
Although, I will say, there's that thing after you get, it's not stay up all night, but it's like get too little sleep, where you have like 2 hours where you feel fucking awesome. Everything is going into overdrive just to keep you from collapsing. You feel great.
Mm-hmm. And
that's a really nice little period. And then, that gets rough.
Yeah, that was around 3 a.m. For me last night. And I'm not allowed to trust that feeling as a heavily medicated bipolar person.
Right.
So anytime that happens and I'm like, you know what? I'm pretty conscious. I feel pretty. Oh no. Thankfully right. That doesn't seem to be the case here, but you know, not a thing that I should do for the sake of my sanity. Anyway. Yeah. So that's my lemon. Who has lemons?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I got one, but Maki, do you want to go first?
I was actually having trouble with this cause, initially, like, I feel like all my lemons are gigantic lemons. Like,
I think
two big like structural problem lemons at the moment. Like I was feeling pretty good about that I've like kind of like washed the petty grievances out of me, and I only have, you know, problems that I cannot solve, which is actually, hang on, that's like the opposite of good. But yeah, like, you know, like, I don't have any, like, this soup is too hot kind of.
Okay.
All right.
Things.
And that's
I'm sure if I think of one, I'll just blurt it out and viewers can figure out the context of it.
Sure.
All right.
Well, then I will do mine. And I mentioned this briefly at the end, but not the recorded portion of our live stream. So I'm going to talk about it again. I went up to San Francisco this past weekend and stayed with a friend. I went up for a show I was playing, and an old friend was nice enough to accommodate me at his family's house. And I am done with the show, and it's like, you know, I'm sweating like crazy and take a shower after the show to, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I get in this nice, lovely, lovely bed in the bottom floor of his house, and I lay down and I'm reading Ready Player One, my favorite book. And I'm having a, finally I can relax, and I put my hand down on the bed and I'm like, what is that? It was wet. And I was like, wait, is this because I just took a shower? And doing what anyone would do, I smell my hand and realize that their dog has just completely pissed on this bed that I was laying in. And I like turn on the lights, and there's a the dog pissed through the blanket and the sheets onto the mattress. There's a gigantic, impressively round, actually almost perfectly circular, thanks to diffusion, yellow spot on the bed. Actually, as I would discover the next day, there were two about a few inches apart from each other. But yeah, it was exactly in the middle of the bed. So I was like, oh, fuck. And so I went, I washed my hand. Well, at first I licked it off. And then I went and I washed my hand. Free piss, right? You're not going to turn that down. That's a good deal on piss. Anyone can admit that.
Valuable water.
Yeah, that's right. In this economy.
Bed's so nice, you'll piss it twice.
That's right, yeah. So I washed my hand, get back in bed. And I'm like, well, if I lay on this side, I won't. You know, I can get new. There's luckily I saw new blankets that were not covered in dog piss. And I slept just fine, or as fine as one can sleep next to a known piss site. So that's my lemon.
That's some danger sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
That's
and also,
piss stains.
Yeah, I'm an active sleeper. I'm not going to cut that. I'm an active sleeper, and so I had zero confidence that I wouldn't roll over and just, like, you know, own myself by rolling right into a as the British say, a spot of piss.
Well, you know, the only way that you can assert your dominance over the dog is by also pissing on it.
Yeah. Well, you do that when you meet a dog. Rule. Yeah, you know, they have to, you have to establish yourself as the alpha. So, yeah, a lovely dog, must say. Very nice dog. But would have preferred had it not pissed on the bed.
Dogs are, you usually like them more when they, when you haven't come into contact with their bodily fluids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's my lemon.
Great. So let's do peaches, of which we will each do three. Big, small.
We eat them all.
Oh, and right on cue, my AC has turned itself off for some unknowable reason. God help us all. I will also go first again. Peaches. Peach number one. Whoever came up with the honey mustard dusting on pretzels. Great job.
Real. Yes, very I real. Don't Snyder's? We talking Snyder's?
Oh, we're not even talking Snyder's. It's some other brand. And I've been looking for the Snyder's ones because I haven't seen them in the store lately. But these are like long pretzel twists too. So there's just like more surface area for that delicious honey mustard, that honey musty dusty.
Episode title has occurred. Honey musty dusty.
Yeah, so that's up there with like white cheddar in terms of most delicious flavor of dust.
Dots, is that the kind of pretzel you got? Because I know they have
mustard. I forget what I've never seen the brand before, but it's like a huge bag too. Like as a chip enthusiast, I'm always upset when it's like, this is mostly air. No, yep. This thing is like heavy. Cool. So yeah, honey musty pretz. That's my number one. Yeah. My second one is it's nice to meet an internet friend in real life, which I got to do recently. Because I was hanging out with Aaron and Jory, and I got to meet Harry after many, many nights gaming.
Oh, lovely. Great.
Yeah. So that was very fun. And then my third peach is that I don't know exactly what caused it. I don't know if it's the live call-in shows that we've been doing or whatever else, but we've had a lot more folks joining our late night Discord. And it's just really nice to see, you know, to put a name and an icon to the invisible audience of this show. So I thank you for your support. And for anybody who's not there yet, come hang out with us.
That is, I love that community. Really cool, wonderful people. And it is a bright spot, yeah, for sure. So yeah, thank you all for being a part of that. Cool.
Either Maki, of you, peaches?
Yeah, you want to do some peaches?
All right. I kind of mentioned this earlier a little bit, but I am grateful for being able to reconnect with my artwork after, about 5-6 years of just being in a funk where I thought like, oh, this funk will. You know, this is just a slump. I'm just feeling a little blur. It'll wear off. And then, like, you know, half a decade later, I'm just miserable. But it's been great, you know, drawing more and having fun with it and being able to have fun despite everything else going on. And, well, again, both personally and with the wider, you know, industry crap and, you know, everything going on. It all sucks out there. The world's on fire. I am grateful that I can find, you know, kind of take back a little bit of that joy that I got of creating artwork. That's been really great. My shout out, to jalapeno peppers. In my vegetable eating phase, and by eating vegetables, I mean just eating raw jalapeno peppers.
Okay.
Usually with stuff, like I've been like mixing it with like hummus and other things.
Nice. Good combo.
But, So here's what I've been doing. You've been eating more hummus because it's, you know, it's healthier than like cream cheese.
It's yummus.
but And then recently we were, you know, we went through another like giant tub of hummus, and I was just like, we could just like make this stuff. And like my wife just made, just, you know, just the other afternoon, just made a big tub of homemade hummus, and it's great. It's perfect.
Yeah.
And put a little sesame oil in it, and it's just perfect.
Oh, that's smart.
That's great.
You so put shout garlic out to my in wife, there?
It was awesome. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, hell yeah.
So, and what I've been doing lately is, yeah, in addition to, you know, chopping up some jalapeno pepper for the crunchy bits, is also if you get that, like, if you go to an Asian food mart and get a little chili crisp.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's...
You know what that...
Yes, like the kind in the jar?
Yeah.
Little jar,
Put a little bit of that in there, and it's just, the flavors are just...
Genius.
It's great. I've been eating that for, like, a snack, like, every day.
And that's then, fantastic.
But yeah, jalapeno peppers. Love peppers. And then I guess my third thing, just as kind of a bigger, you know, again, shout out to my wife, who is a brilliant designer and a partner in kind of a lot of what I do as well, of like, you know, advocacy for self-employment and for artists, and like trying to like bring people up and like show people that it can be done and you can work for yourself and make money making artwork. And all the time I don't want to get into too many specifics or anything, but like I feel like there's so many times where we just look at each other and we're just like, wow, I'm so glad for what we have, because what's going on over there is messed up, or like, can you imagine being them, or like, it's just great. Love her to death. And I'm constantly like, my number one thing when I try to be like mindful and grateful is to think about her and my dog and the house that we have, and just kind of being able to have our own little chunk of happiness.
That's lovely.
Living the dream.
Great. Indeed.
Brian.
You sound scared. And you should be. All right, peach number one, for months, possibly even a year, we have like a double oven, upper oven, lower oven. Upper oven's been broken, not heating up. One of those things where we never use two ovens at the same time, except like on Thanksgiving. And so we just kind of haven't worried about it. And I finally called a repair guy, and, first of all, the person came so far outside the promised window. It was actually insane. Like 4 hours earlier than they said they were going to show up. But it ended up being the perfect time for this guy to show up, because the other window was like now. And I told them, no, I'm like later, like show up after 3 p.m. our time. Turns out this guy got here at like 10 o'clock, fixed the problem right away. The oven works now. It was fast, it was easy, and by not doing what they said they were going to do, showing up the wrong time, it actually worked out perfectly. Because normally it's the other thing. You're waiting around for hours, and you're like, when the fuck is this guy going to get here? Much better. So that's my first peach. I now have a double oven that works, which is great. It was the igniter.
Are you going to christen the fixed one with anything special?
We don't have anything in mind, although I'm defrosting some impossible meat at the moment, so we'll see. But usually that might turn into a meatloaf. I don't know. Peach number two is already would have happened by the time this comes out, but I'll talk about it anyway. The 15th anniversary stream for Ninja Sex Party is happening this weekend as we record, in the past as you listen, but I'm glad this thing is finally happening, because it's been 15 years in the making in some sense. So it's nice to do it, and it's going to be great. My biggest peach, and did I talk about this on the show? Audrey, my 10-year-old, just started fifth grade, and it's a new school, and we were very nervous, but she loves it. And it was a huge sigh of relief. That first day at the new school, Rachel and I were like, please, please, please let her like this. And she came home, and she was beaming. She's having a great time. She loves the new school. And that is such a relief as a parent to think, okay, whew. Seems like we made the right decision. Every decision you make as a parent, you're like, well, is this the one she's going to be talking about to a therapist in 30 years? And that may yet be true, but so far, signs point to that she likes it, which is a huge relief. So those are my peaches. Yeah.
Hooray. And that's all of our peaches. And one final peach, Maki, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah.
Thank you for being so generous with your time. If people want to check out your work or anywhere else on the internet you want to point them, where should they go?
I guess my portfolio is at makinero.com. Still kind of getting that up and running and uploading new stuff. I have to look at what my actual, mostly social media wise, I'm on Blue Sky. You know, not any of the other places.
Blue Sky?
Really.
It's pretty good. I gotta say,
it's got a really strong art community going on. You know, it's
good,
not
science community.
Yeah, it's not run by, you know, that guy. It's not actively trying to steal your art like Meta Facebook stuff. Right now it's kind of like the only place I can be. My handle there is makinero.bsky.social. I'm probably the only Makinero on there, so
probably
it's one of the nice things I've had in life is that I don't usually have to fight for usernames.
It's Maki, it's so great to see you. I'm glad we had a chance to catch up. I am a genuine fan of your work. Your stuff is just wonderful, and I really do want everyone listening to this to go check it out because you're the best. So
thank you so much. You know, like, yeah, we don't talk enough because I didn't know that Brian. And it really warms my heart, like, because I always look fondly over at what you're up to too. And you know what, I don't know if I complimented you on your it was almost a year ago when Trey Magnifique album came out.
I think you might have said something. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
You know, I loved it.
Thank you.
But yeah, so if anything, we just need to chat more.
I couldn't agree more. I would love to. Anytime. I'll be there.
It was so nice to meet you, Layton.
Yeah, it was lovely meeting you too and getting to discover your work through Brian. Good. Yeah. I'm glad. That's my favorite thing to hear from a guest. And in that spirit, you know, I kind of like to end episodes with a few words of wisdom sometimes. Mm-hmm. Doesn't always happen, but I see myself as a bit of a Marcus Aurelius type figure in terms of dispensing wisdom. I have a Discord channel with myself called the Shit Zone. It's for me and only for me, and for me to send, you know, things to myself on various devices. And I just want to share the message that I forgot that I wrote to myself at 2:38 a.m. this morning, whatever. Yeah. It simply says, Gunter S. Thompson.
Great.
So chew on that.
That's a deep cut reference for all you Klein heads out there.
Yeah. For all those Ready Player One fans out there.
Yeah.
It's a real thinker, but, you know, maybe you'll get it someday if you get on Ernest Klein's level. Yeah. All right. Well, goodbye.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Late Night is produced by Brian Wecht and Leighton Gray. Sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/LeightonNight. Follow us on Twitter at LeightonNight, on Instagram at @Leighton_Night, or email us at LeightonNight@gmail.com.